she got the number for the hospital. Moment later, she heard the receptionist say, "Long Beach Memorial." "I want to talk to the morgue," she said. "I'm sorry, the morgue is at the county coroner's office. Would you like that number?" "Someone in my family just died at your hospital. Where would his body be now?" "One moment, please. I will connect you to pathology." 4 days later, her mother called back.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?"
"What do you mean?"
"I mean going down to the hospital and asking for blood from your father."
"He's not my father."
"Lisa, don't you ever get tired of this game?"
"No, and he's not my father, because the genetic test came back negative. It says right here," she reached for the printed sheet, "that there is less than one chance in 2.9 million that John J. Weller is my father."
"What genetic test?"
"I had a genetic test done."
"You're so full of shit."
"No, Mom, you're the one who's full of shit. John Weller's not my father, and the test proves it. I always knew it."
"We'll see about that,"
her mother said, and hung up. About half an hour after that, her brother Tom called. "Hey, Lise." Real casual, laid back. "Just got a call from Mom."
"Yeah?"
"She said something about a test."
"Yeah. I did a test, Tommy, and guess what?"
"I heard."
"Who did this test, Lise?"
"A lab here in Long Beach." "What's it called?"
"Bio-rad testing."
"Uh-huh," her brother said. "You know, these labs that advertise on the Internet aren't very reliable. You know that, don't you?"
"They guaranteed it."
Mom's all upset.
"Too bad," she said.
"You know, she'll do her own test now, and there's going to be lawsuits because you're accusing her of infidelity."
"Gee, Tommy, I don't really give a damn, you know that?"
"Lise, I think this is causing a lot of needless trouble around Dad's death."
"Your dad," she said, "not mine."
Kevin McCormick, chief administrator of Long Beach Memorial, looked up at the chubby figure coming into his office and said, "How the hell did this happen?" He pushed a sheaf of papers across his desk. Marty Roberts, the chief of pathology, glanced quickly through the document.
"I have no idea," he said.
"The wife of the deceased, Mr. John J. Weller, is suing us for unauthorized release of tissue to the daughter."
"What's the legal situation?"
Marty Roberts said. "Unclear," McCormick said. "Legal says the daughter is a family member and has a clear right to be given tissues to test for diseases that may affect her. Problem is, she did a paternity test, and it came back negative, so she's not his daughter. Arguably, that makes our release of tissues unauthorized."
"We couldn't have known that at the time."
"Of course not, but we're talking about the law. The only important question is, can the family sue? The answer is yes. They have grounds to bring a suit, and they are."
"Where's the body now?"
Marty said. "Buried 8 days ago." "I see." Marty flipped through the pages. "And they are asking for, beside unspecified damages, they're asking for blood and tissue samples to conduct further testing," McCormick said. "Do we have blood or tissue samples from the deceased?"
"I'd have to check," Marty said, "but I'd presume that we do, yes."
"We do?"
"Sure, we keep a lot of tissue these days, Kevin. I mean, everybody that comes into the hospital, we collect as much as we possibly can legally."
"That's the wrong answer," McCormick said, glowering.
"Okay, what's the right answer?"
"That we don't have any tissues from this guy."
"But they'll know that we do. At the very least, we did a tox screen on the guy because of the accident, so we have his blood."
"That sample was lost."
"Okay, it was lost. But what good does that do? They can always dig up the body and get all the tissues they want."
"Correct."
So
let them do that. That's legal's advice. Exhumation takes time, permits, and money.
We're guessing they won't have the time or the money, and this thing will go away.
Okay, Marty said. And I am here because...
Because I need you to go back to pathology and confirm for me that, unfortunately, we have no more samples from the deceased, and that everything not given to the daughter has been lost or misplaced.
Got it. Call me within the hour, McCormick said, and turned away. Marty Roberts entered the basement pathology lab. His deaner, Raza Rashad, a handsome, dark-eyed man of 27, was scrubbing the stainless steel tables for the next post. If truth be told, Raza really ran the path lab. Marty felt himself burdened by a heavy administrative load, managing the senior pathologists, the residents, the medical student rotations, and all the rest. He'd come to rely on Raza, who was highly intelligent and ambitious.
"Hey, Raza, you remember that 46-year-old white guy with crush injuries a week back drove himself into an overpass?"
"Yeah, I remember Heller or Weller."
"The daughter asked for blood?"
"Yeah, we gave her blood."
"Well, she ran a paternity test, and it came back negative. Guy was not her father."
Raza stared blankly.
"That right?"
"Yeah. Now the mother's all upset. Wants more tissues. What have we got?"
"I'd have to check. Probably the usual. All major organs."
Marty said, "Any chance that material got misplaced so we couldn't find it?" Raza nodded slowly, staring at Marty.
"Maybe so. Always possible it could be mislabeled. Then it would be hard to find."
"Might take months."
"Or years. Maybe never."
"That'd be a shame," Marty said. "Now what about the blood from the tox screen?" Raza frowned.
"Lab keeps that. We wouldn't have access to their storage facility."
"So they still have that blood sample?"
"Yeah, they do."
"And we have no access?" Raza smiled.
"It might take me a couple of days."
"Okay. Do it."
Marty Roberts went to the phone and dialed the administrator's office. When McCormick came on the line, he said, "I have some bad news, Kevin. Unfortunately, all the tissues have been lost or misplaced."
"Sorry to hear that," McCormick said, and hung up.
"Marty," Raza said, coming into the office, "is there a problem with this Weller guy?"
"No," Marty said. "Not anymore. And I told you before, don't call me Marty. My name is Dr. Roberts." At the radial genomics lab in La Jolla, Charlie Huggins twisted his flat panel screen around to show Henry Kendall the headline.
"Talking ape claimed fraud."
"What did I tell you?" Charlie said. "A week later, and we learn the story's a fake."
"Okay, okay, I was wrong," Henry said. "I admit it. I was worried about nothing."
"Very worried."
"It's in the past. Can we talk about something important?"
"What's that?"
"The novelty-seeking gene. Our grant application was denied." He began typing at the keyboard. "Once again, we've been screwed by your personal favorite, the Pope of Dopamine, Dr. Robert A. Bellarmino of the NIH.
For the last 10 years, brain studies had increasingly focused on a neurochemical called dopamine. Levels of dopamine seem to be important in maintaining health as well as in diseases such as Parkinsonism and schizophrenia. From work in Charlie Huggins' lab, it appeared that dopamine receptors in the brain were controlled by the gene D4DR, among others. Charlie's lab stood at the forefront of this research until a rival scientist named Robert Bellarmino from the National Institutes of Health began referring to D4DR as the novelty gene, the gene that supposedly controlled the urge to take risks, seek new sex partners, or engage in thrill-seeking behavior. As Bellarmino explained it, the fact that dopamine levels were higher in men than women was the reason for the greater recklessness of men and their attraction to everything from mountain climbing to infidelity. Bellarmino was an evangelical Christian and a leading researcher at the NIH. Politically skilled, he was the very model of an up-to-date scientist,
neatly blending a modest scientific talent with true media savvy. His laboratory was the first to hire its own publicity firm, and as a result, his ideas invariably got plenty of press coverage, which in turn attracted the brightest and most ambitious postdocs, who did brilliant work for him, thus adding to his prestige. In the case of D4DR, Bellarmino was able to tailor his comments to the beliefs of his audience, either speaking enthusiastically about the new gene to progressive groups or disparaging it to conservatives. He was colorful, future-oriented, and uninhibited in his predictions. He went so far as to suggest that there might one day be a vaccine to prevent infidelity. The absurdity of such comments so annoyed Charlie and Henry that 6 months before they had applied for a grant to test the prevalence of the novelty gene. Their proposal was simplicity itself. They would send research teams to amusement parks to draw blood samples from individuals who rode roller coasters time and again during the day. In theory, these repeat coasters would be more likely to carry the gene. The only problem with applying to the NSF was that their proposal would be read by anonymous reviewers, and one of the reviewers was likely to be Robert Bellarmino. And Bellarmino had a reputation for what was politely termed appropriation.
"Anyway," Henry said, "the NSF turned us down. The reviewers didn't think our idea was worthy. One said it was too jokey."
"Uh-huh," Charlie said. "What does this have to do with Rob and Rob? Remember where we proposed to conduct our study?"
"Of course," Charlie said. "At two of the biggest amusement parks in the world, in two different countries, Sandusky in the U.S. and Blackpool in England."
"Well, guess who's out of town?" Henry said.
He hit his email button.
"From Rob Bellarmino, NIH, out of office auto reply, Ray, travel. I will be out of the office for the next 2 weeks. If you need immediate assistance, please contact my office by phone."
I called his office, and guess what? Bellarmino is going to Sandusky, Ohio, and then to Blackpool, England.
"That bastard," Charlie said. "If you're going to steal somebody else's research proposal, you should at least have the courtesy to change it a little."
"Bellarmino obviously doesn't care if we know he stole it," Henry said.
"Doesn't that piss you off? What do you say we go for it? Put him up for ethical violations."
"I'd like nothing better," Charlie said.
"But no. If we formally charge misconduct, it means a lot of time and a lot of paperwork. Our grants could dry up. And in the end, the complaint goes nowhere. Rob's a major player at NIH. He's got huge research facilities, and he dispenses millions in grants. He holds prayer breakfasts with congressmen. He's a scientist who believes in God. They love him on the Hill. He'd never be charged with misconduct. Even if we caught him buggering a lab assistant, he wouldn't be charged."
"So we just let him do it?"
"It's not a perfect world," Charlie said. "We have plenty to do. Walk away."
Barry Sindler was bored. The woman before him yammered on. She was an obvious type, the rich bitch Eastern broad who wore pants. Katharine Hepburn with an attitude, a trust fund, a nasal Newport accent. But despite her aristocratic airs, the best she could manage was to hump the tennis pro, just like every L.A. fake-tit dimwit in this town. But she was perfectly suited to the dumbass attorney by her side, that Ivy League jack-off Bob Wilson, wearing a pinstripe suit and a button-down shirt with a rep tie and those stupid lace-up wingtips with the little perforations in the toes. No wonder everyone called him Whitey Wilson. Wilson never tired of reminding everyone he was a Harvard-trained lawyer, as if anybody gave a shit. Certainly Barry Sindler didn't, because he knew Wilson was a gentleman, which really meant he was chicken shit. He wouldn't go for the throat. And Sindler always went for the throat. The woman, Karen Deal, was still talking. Jesus, these rich bitches could talk. Sindler didn't interrupt her because he didn't want Whitey to state on the record that Sindler was badgering the woman.
Wilson had said that 4 times already, so fine, let the bitch talk. Let her tell in full, exhausting, incredibly, stupefyingly boring detail why her husband was a lousy father and a total shitheel. Because the truth was, she was the one who'd had the affair. Not that that could ever come out in court. California had no-fault divorce, which meant there were no specific grounds for divorce, just irreconcilable differences. But a woman's infidelity always colored the proceedings, because in skilled hands, Barry's hands, that fact could easily be turned into the insinuation that this woman had more important priorities than her darling children. She was a neglectful parent, an unreliable custodian, a selfish woman who sought her own pleasure while she left the kids all day with a Spanish-speaking maid. And she was good-looking at 28, he thought. That worked against her, too. Indeed, Barry Sindler could see his central theme shaping up quite nicely, and Whitey Wilson looked a bit anxious. He probably knew where Sindler would take this. Or maybe Whitey was troubled by the fact that Sindler was attending the depot at all, because ordinarily Barry Sindler didn't conduct spousal depots. He left those to the jerk-off peons in his office while he spent his days downtown racking up expensive courtroom hours. Finally, the woman stopped to catch her breath. Sindler moved in. "Mrs. Deal, I would like to hold this line of questioning and go on to another issue. We are formally requesting that you undergo a full battery of genetic tests at a reputable facility, preferably UCLA, and..." The woman sat bolt upright. Her face colored swiftly. "No."
"Let's not be hasty," Whitey said, putting his hand on his client's arm. She angrily pushed him away.
"No, absolutely not. I refuse."
How wonderful. How unexpected and wonderful.
"In anticipation of your possible refusal," Sindler continued, "we have drafted a request that the court order these tests." He passed a document to Whitey. "And we fully expect the judge to agree."
"I've never heard of such a thing," Whitey said, thumbing through the pages. "Genetic testing in a custody case?"
By now, Mrs. Deal was full bore hysterical.
"No. No, I will not. It's his idea, isn't it? That prick. How dare he? That sneaking son of a bitch."
Whitey was looking at his client with a puzzled expression.
"Mrs. Deal," he said, "I think it's best if we discuss this in private."
"No. No discussion. No test. That's it. No." "In that case," Sindler said with a little shrug, "we have no choice but to go to the judge." "Fuck you. Fuck him. Fuck all of you. No fucking test."
And she stood up, grabbed her purse, and stomped out of the room, slamming the door behind her. There was a moment of silence. Sindler said, "Let the record show that at 3:45 p.m., the witness left the room, thus ending the deposition." He began to put his papers into his briefcase. Whitey Wilson said,
"I've never heard of this, Barry. What's genetic testing got to do with child custody?"
"That's what the tests are intended to find out," Sindler said. "This is a new procedure, but I think you'll find it's the coming thing."
He snapped his briefcase shut, shook Whitey's limp hand, and left the office. Josh Winkler closed the door to his office and started toward the cafeteria when his phone rang. It was his mother. She was being pleasant, always a danger sign.
"Josh, dear, I want you to tell me, what have you done to your brother?"
"What do you mean, done to him? I haven't done anything. I haven't seen him in 2 weeks since I picked him up from jail."
"Adam had his arraignment today," she said.
and Charles was there, representing him.
Uh-huh, waiting for the other shoe to drop.
And?
Adam came to court on time, in a clean shirt and tie, clean suit, haircut, even his shoes polished. He pleaded guilty, asked to be put in a drug program, said he had not used in 2 weeks, said he had gotten a job.
What?
Yes, he's got a job, apparently as a limo driver for his old company. Been working there steadily for the last 2 weeks. Charles says he's gained weight.
I don't believe this, Josh said.
I know, she said. Charles didn't either, but he swears it's all true. Adam's like a new man. He's acquired a newfound maturity. It's like he suddenly grew up. It's a miracle, don't you think? Joshua, are you there?
I'm here, he said after a pause.
Isn't it a miracle?
Yes, Mom, a miracle.
I called Adam. He has a cell phone now, and he answered right away. And he says you did something to help him. What did you do?
Nothing, Mom. We just had a talk.
He said you gave him some genetic thing, an inhaler.
Oh, Jesus, he thought. There are rules against this kind of thing, serious rules. Human experimentation without formal application, meetings of the approvals board, following the federal guidelines. Josh would be fired in an instant.
No, Mom, I think he must be misremembering. He was pretty whacked out at the time.
He said there was a spray.
No, Mom. He inhaled some mouse spray. No, Mom.
He said he did.
No, Mom.
Well, don't be so defensive, she said.
I thought you would be pleased.
I mean, you're always looking for new drugs, Joshua. Big commercial applications.
I mean, what if this spray gets people off drugs? What if it breaks their addiction?
Joshua was shaking his head. Mom, really, nothing happened.
Okay, fine. You don't want to tell me the truth. I get it. Was it something experimental? Is that what your spray is?
Mom!
Because the thing is, Josh, I told Lois Graham about it because her Eric dropped out of USC. He's on crack or smack or...
Mom!
And she wants to try this spray on him.
Oh, Jesus.
Mom! You can't talk about this.
And Helen Stern, her daughter is on sleeping pills. She crashed her car.
They're talking about putting her baby in foster care, and Helen wants...
Mom, please, you can't talk about it anymore.
Are you crazy? I have to talk about it, she said. You gave me my son back. It's a miracle. Don't you realize, Joshua, you have performed a miracle. The whole world is going to talk about what you've done, whether you like it or not.
He was beginning to sweat, to feel dizzy, but suddenly his vision became clear and calm. The whole world is going to talk about it.
Of course, that was true. If you could get people off drugs, it would be the most valuable pharmaceutical in the last decade. Everybody would want it. And what if it did more? Could it cure obsessive-compulsive disorders? Could it cure attention deficit disorders?
The maturity gene had behavioral effects. They already knew that. Adam sniffing that aerosol was a gift from God. And his next thought was, what's the state of the patent application on ACMPD3N7? He decided to skip lunch and head back to the office.
Mom. Yes, Josh?
I need your help.
Of course, dear, anything.
I need you to do something for me, and not to talk about it to anyone, ever.
Well, that's difficult.
Yes or no, Mom?
Well, all right, dear.
You said that Lois Graham's son is on smack and dropped out of college?
Yes.
Where is he now?
Apparently, she said, he is downtown in some god-awful flop house off campus.
Do you know where?
No, but Lois went to see him. She told me it was squalid. It's on East 38th. Some old frame house with faded blue shutters. 8 or 9 addicts are there, sleeping on the floor. But I can call Lois and ask her...
No, he said quickly. Don't do anything, Mom.
But you said you needed my help.
That's for later, Mom. For now, everything is fine. I'll call you in a day or so. He scribbled on a pad. Eric Graham, East 38th Street, Frame House, Blue Shutters. He reached for his car keys. Rachel Allen, who worked in the dispensary, said,
You still haven't signed back in 1 oxygen canister from 2 weeks ago, Josh, or the virus vial that was with it. The company measured remaining virus in returning vials as a way of keeping a rough track of dosages to the rats.
Yes, he said. I know. I keep forgetting.
Where is it?
It's in my car.
In your car?
Josh, that's a contagious retrovirus.
Yeah, for mice.
Even so, it must remain in a negative pressure laboratory environment at all times.
Rachel was a stickler for the rules. Nobody really paid attention to her.
I know, Rach, he said, but I had a family emergency. I had to get my brother,
he dropped his voice,
out of jail.
Really?
Yes.
For what?
He hesitated.
Armed robbery.
Really?
Liquor store. Mom is crushed. Anyway, I'll bring the canister back to you. Meanwhile, can I have one more?
We only sign out 1 at a time.
I need 1 more now. Please. I'm under a lot of pressure.
Light rain was falling. The streets were slick with oil and shimmered in rainbow patterns. Beneath low, angry clouds, he drove down East 38th Street. It was an old section of town, bypassed by modern rebuilding farther north. Here, houses built in the 1920s and 1930s were still standing. Josh drove past several wood-frame houses in various states of disrepair. One had a blue door, none had blue shutters. He ended up in the warehouse district, the street lined with loading docks. He turned around and headed back. He drove as slowly as he could, and finally he saw the house. It was not actually on 38th, but on the corner of 38th and Alameda, tucked back behind high weeds and ratty bushes. An old mattress streaked with rust lay on the sidewalk in front of the house. There was a truck tire on the front lawn. A battered VW bus was pulled up to the curb. Josh parked across the street. He watched the house and waited. The coffin rose into sunlight. It looked the same as it had when buried a week earlier, except for the clumps of dirt that dropped from the underside.
This is all so undignified,
Emily Weller said. She stood stiffly at the graveside, accompanied by her son Tom and her daughter Rachel. Of course, Lisa was not there. She was the cause of all this, but she could not be bothered to see what she had done to her poor father. The coffin swung slowly in the air as the graveside workers guided it to the far side of the pit under the direction of the hospital pathologist, a nervous little man named Marty Roberts. He should be nervous, Emily thought, if he was the one who had given the blood to Lisa without anybody's permission.
What happens now?
Emily said, turning to her son. Tom was 26, dressed in a sharp suit and tie. He had a master's degree in microbiology and worked for a big biotech company in Los Angeles. Tom had turned out good, as had her daughter, Rachel. Rachel was a senior at USC studying business administration.
Will they take Jack's blood here?
Oh, they'll take more than blood, Tom said.
Emily said, What do you mean?
You see, Tom said, for a genetic test like this, where there is a dispute, they ordinarily take tissues from several organ systems.
I didn't realize,
Emily said, frowning. She felt her heart pounding, thumping in her chest. She hated that feeling. Soon there was a squeezing feeling in her throat. It was painful. She bit her lip. You all right, Mom?
I should have taken my anxiety pills.
Rachel said,
Will this take long?
No, Tom said. It should only be a few minutes. The pathologist will open the casket to confirm the identity of the body. Then he'll take it back to the hospital to remove the tissues for genetic analysis. He'll return the body for reburial tomorrow or the next day.
Tomorrow or the next day?
Emily said. She sniffled, wiped her eyes.
You mean we have to come back here? We have to bury Jack again. This is all so...
I know, Mom. He patted her arm. I'm sorry, but there's no other way. You see, they have to check for something called a chimera.
Oh, don't tell me,
she said, waving her hand.
I won't know what you're talking about.
Okay, Mom. He put his arm around her shoulder. In ancient mythology, chimeras were monsters composed of different animal parts. The original chimera had the head of a lion, the body of a goat, and a serpent's tail. Some chimeras were part human, like the Egyptian Sphinx, with the body of a lion, the wings of a bird, and the head of a woman. But true human chimeras, meaning people with two sets of DNA, had been discovered only recently. A woman needing a kidney transplant had tested her own children as possible donors, only to discover that they did not share her DNA. She was told the children weren't hers, and was asked to prove she had actually given birth to them. A lawsuit ensued. After considerable study, doctors realized that her body contained two different strands of DNA. In her ovaries, they found eggs with two kinds of DNA. The skin cells of her abdomen had her children's DNA. The skin on her shoulders did not. She was a mosaic in every organ of her body. It turned out that the woman had originally been one of a pair of fraternal twins, but early in development, her sister's embryo had fused with hers, so she was now literally herself and her own twin. More than 50 chimeras had since been reported. Scientists now suspected that chimerism was not as rare as they had once thought. Certainly, whenever there was a difficult question of paternity, chimerism had to be considered. It was possible that Lisa's father might be a chimera. But to determine that, they would need tissues from every organ of his body, and preferably from several different places on each organ. That was why Dr. Roberts was required to take so many tissue samples, and why it would have to be done at the hospital, not at the gravesite. Dr. Roberts raised the lid and turned to the family on the opposite side of the grave. Would one of you make the identification, please?
I will,
Tom said. He walked around the grave and looked into the coffin. His father appeared surprisingly unchanged, except the skin was much grayer, a dark gray now, and the limbs seemed to have shrunk, to have lost mass, especially the legs inside the trousers. In a formal voice, the pathologist said, "Is this your father, John J. Weller?"
"Yes, he is. Yes."
"All right. Thank you."
Tom said, "Dr. Roberts, I know you have your procedures, but if there is any way you can take the tissues here so my mother doesn't have to go through another day and another burial..."
"I'm sorry," Marty Roberts said. "My actions are governed by state law. We're required to take the body to the hospital for examination.
If you could, just this once, bend..."
"I'm sorry. I wish I could." Tom nodded and walked back to his mother and sister. His mother said,
"What was all that about?"
"Just asking a question." Tom looked back and saw that Dr. Roberts was now bent over, his body half inside the casket. Abruptly, the pathologist rose up. He walked over to speak in Tom's ear so no one else could hear. "Mr. Weller, perhaps we should spare your family's feelings. If we can keep this between us..."
"Of course. Then you'll..."
"Yes. We'll do everything here. It should take only a few moments. Let me get my kit." He hurried off to a nearby SUV. Emily bit her lip.
"What's he doing?"
"I asked him to do all the tests here, Mom."
"And he said yes?" "Thank you, dear," she said, and kissed her son.
Will he do all the tests that he would do at the hospital?
No, but it should be enough to answer your questions.
20 minutes later, the tissue samples had been taken and placed in a series of glass tubes. The tubes were placed in slots in a metal refrigeration case. The casket was returned to the grave, disappearing into shadow.
"Come on,"
Emily Weller said to her children.
"Let's get out of here. I need a damn drink."
As they drove away, she said to Tom,
"I'm sorry you had to do that. Was Jack's poor body very decayed, dear?"
"No," Tom said. "Not much, no."
"Oh, that's good,"
Emily said.
"That's very good."
Marty Roberts was sweating by the time he got back to Long Beach Memorial Hospital. Because of what he had done at the cemetery, he could lose his license. No problem. One of those grave diggers could pick up the phone and call the county. The county could wonder why Marty had broken protocol, especially with a lawsuit pending. When you take tissues in the field, you risk contamination. Everybody knew that. So the county might start wondering why Marty Roberts would risk that. And before long, they might be wondering...
Shit. Shit, shit, shit.
He pulled into the emergency parking next to the ambulances and hurried down the basement hallway to pathology. It was lunchtime. Almost nobody was there. The rows of stainless steel tables stood empty. Raza was washing up.
"You dumb fuck," Marty said. "Are you trying to get us both in jail?"
Raza turned slowly.
"What is the problem?" he said quietly.
"The problem," Marty said, "is that I told you, take the bones only on the cremations. Not the burials, the cremations. Is that so fucking hard to understand?"
"Yeah, well, that's what I do," Raza said.
"No, that's not what you do, because I just came from an exhumation, and you know what I saw when I dug the guy up? Very fucking skinny legs, Raza. Very skinny arms. In a burial."
"No," Raza said, "that's not what I do."
"Well, somebody took the bones."
Raza headed to the office.
"What's the name of this guy?"
"Weller."
"What?
That guy again. He's the guy we lost the tissues for, right?"
"Right. So the family exhumed him, because he was buried."
Raza leaned over the desk, keyed in the patient name. He stared at the screen.
"Oh, yeah. You're right. It was a burial. But I didn't do that one."
Marty said,
"You didn't do that one. Who the fuck did?"
Raza shrugged. "My brother came in, that's all. I had an appointment that night."
"Your brother?" "What brother? Nobody else is supposed to be..."
"Don't sweat it, Marty," Raza said. "My brother comes in from time to time. He knows what to do. He works at Hilldale Mortuary."
Marty wiped sweat from his forehead.
"Jesus, how long has this been going on?"
"Maybe a year."
"A year?"
"Only at night, Marty. Late night only. He wears my lab coat. Looks like me. We look the same."
"Wait a minute," Marty said. "Who gave that girl the blood sample? That girl Lisa Weller?"
"Okay,"
Raza said.
"So sometimes he makes mistakes."
"And sometimes he works afternoons?"
"Only Sundays, Marty. If I have appointments is all."
Marty gripped the edge of the desk to steady himself. He leaned over and breathed deeply.
"Some fucking guy who doesn't even work for the hospital gave unauthorized blood to a woman because she asked for it? Is that what you're telling me?"
"Not some fucking guy. My brother."
"Jesus."
"He said she was cute."
"That explains everything."
"Come on, Marty," Raza said in a soothing tone. "I'm sorry about the Weller guy, I really am. But anybody could have made the switch.
Fucking cemetery could have dug him up and taken the long bones. Grave diggers working as independent contractors could have done it. You know it happens all over. They got those guys in Phoenix, and the ones in Minnesota, and now Brooklyn.
And they're all in jail now, Raza." "Okay," Raza said. "That's true. The thing is, I told my brother to do it."
"You did?"
"Yeah. That particular night,
The Weller body came in.
We had a stat call for Bone, and the Weller guy typed right.
So, do we fill the order or what? Because you know those Bone guys can take their business elsewhere. To them, now means now. Supply or die.
Marty sighed. Yeah. When they call stat, you should fill it.
Okay, then.
Marty slid into the chair and began typing at the keyboard himself. However, he said, if you extracted those long bones 8 days ago, I don't see any payment transfer to me.
Don't worry. It's coming.
The check is in the mail.
Hey, I forgot. You'll get your taste.
Make sure of it, Marty said. He turned to go. And keep your fucking brother out of the hospital from now on. You understand me?
Sure, Marty. Sure.
Marty Roberts went outside to move his car from the emergency space. He backed out and drove to the doctors-only section of the parking garage. Then he sat in his car for a long time, thinking about Raza.
You'll get your taste?
It seemed that Raza was starting to believe that this was his program and that Marty Roberts worked for him. Raza was handing out the payments. Raza was deciding who should come in to help. Raza was not behaving like an employee. He was starting to behave like he was in charge, and that was dangerous for all sorts of reasons. Marty had to do something about it, and he had to do it soon, or losing his medical license would be the least of his problems.
At sunset, the titanium cube that housed Biogen Research shimmered with a blinding red glare and bathed the adjacent parking lot in a dark orange color. As President Rick Deal stepped out of the building, he paused to put on his sunglasses, then walked toward his brand-new silver Porsche Carrera SC. He loved this car, which he had bought the week before in celebration of his impending divorce. Fuck. He couldn't believe his eyes. Fuck. 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 His parking spot was empty. The car was gone. That bitch. He didn't know how she had done it, but he was sure she had taken his car. Probably got her boyfriend to arrange it. After all, the new boyfriend was a car dealer, moving up from a tennis pro bitch. He stomped back inside. Bradley Gordon, his chief of security, stood in the waiting area, leaning over the counter, talking to Lisa, the receptionist. Lisa was cute. That was why Rick had hired her.
God damn it, Brad, Rick Deal said. We need to review security tapes on the parking lot.
Brad turned.
Why? What is it? Somebody stole my Porsche.
No shit, Brad said.
When did that happen?
And Rick thought, wrong guy for this job. It wasn't the first time he had thought it.
Let's check the security tapes, Brad.
Yeah, sure, of course, Brad said. He winked at Lisa and then headed back through the keycard swipe door into a secure area. Rick followed, fuming. At one of the two desks in the little glass-walled security office, a kid was minutely examining the palm of his left hand. He ignored the bank of monitors before him.
Jason, Brad said in a warning tone. Mr. Deal is here.
Oh, shit. The kid snapped upright in the chair. Sorry, got a rash. I didn't know if...
Mr. Deal wants to review the security cameras. Which cameras are they exactly, Mr. Deal?
Oh, Jesus. Rick said, the parking lot cameras.
The parking lot, right. Jason, let's start 48 hours back, and
I drove the car to work this morning, Deal said.
Right. What time was that?
I got here at 7.
Right. Jason, let's go back to 7 this morning.
The kid shifted in his chair.
Mr. Gordon, the parking lot cameras are out.
Oh, that's right.
Brad turned to Rick.
The parking lot cameras are out.
Why?
Not sure. We think there's a cable problem.
How long have they been out?
Well?
2 months, the kid said. 2 months? Brad said.
We had to order parts.
What parts?
From Germany.
What parts?
I'd have to look it up.
The kid said, we can still use the roof cameras. Well, then show me the roof cameras, Deal said.
Right. Jason, bring up the roof cameras.
It took them 15 minutes to rewind the digital storage and begin to run it forward. Rick watched his Porsche pull in. He watched himself get out and enter the building. What happened next surprised him. Within 2 minutes, another car pulled up, two men jumped out, broke into his car quickly, and drove it away.
They were waiting for you, Brad said, or following you.
Looks like it, Rick said. Call the police, report it, and tell Lisa I want her to drive me home. Brad blinked at that. The problem, Rick reflected as Lisa drove him home, was that Brad Gordon was an idiot, but Rick couldn't fire him. Brad Gordon, surf bum, ski bum, travel bum, recovering alky and college dropout, was the nephew of Jack Watson, a principal investor in Biogen. Jack Watson had always looked after Brad, had always seen that he had a job, and Brad invariably got into trouble. It was even rumored that Brad had been fucking the wife of the vice president of Gene Systems up in Palo Alto, for which he was duly fired, but not without a big stink from his uncle, who saw no reason why Brad should be let go. It's the vice president's own fault, Watson famously said. But now, no security cameras in the parking lot. For 2 months. It made Rick wonder what else was wrong with security at Biogen. He glanced over at Lisa, who drove serenely. Rick had hired her to be the receptionist soon after he discovered his wife's affair. Lisa had a beautiful profile. She could have been a model. Whoever had refined her nose and chin was a genius. And she had a lovely body, with a narrow waist and perfectly enhanced breasts. She was 20, on her summer break from Crestview State, and she radiated healthy, all-American sexiness. Everyone in the company had the hots for her. So it was surprising that whenever they made love, Lisa just lay there. After a few minutes, she seemed to notice his frustration and would begin to move mechanically and make little panting sounds, as if she had been told that that was what people did in bed. Sometimes, when Rick was worried and preoccupied, she would talk to him, "Oh, baby, yes, baby, do it, baby," as if that was supposed to move things along. But it was only too obvious that she was unmoved. Rick had done a little research and discovered a syndrome called anhedonia, the inability to feel pleasure. Anhedonics exhibited a flat effect, which certainly described Lisa in bed. Interestingly, anhedonia appeared to have a genetic component. It seemed to involve the limbic system of the brain, so there might be a gene for the condition. Rick intended to do a full panel on Lisa one of these days, just to check. Meanwhile, the nights he spent with her might have made him insecure if it were not for Greta, the Austrian postdoc in the microbiology lab. Greta was chunky and had glasses and short, mannish hair, but she fucked like a mink, leaving them both gasping for breath and covered in sweat. Greta was a screamer and a writher and a howler. He felt great afterward. The car pulled up at his new condo. Rick checked for his keys in his pocket. Lisa said matter-of-factly,
"You want me to come up?"
She had beautiful blue eyes with long lashes, beautiful, lush lips. He thought, what the hell? Sure, he said. Come on up. He called his lawyer, Barry Sindler, to report that his wife had stolen his car. You think so? Sindler said. He sounded doubtful. Yeah, I do. She hired some guys. I have it on security tape.
You have her on tape?
No, the guys, but she's behind it.
I'm not so sure, Sindler said.
Usually women trash a husband's car, not steal it.
I'm telling you.
Okay, I'll check into it. But right now, there are a few things I want to go over with you about the litigation.
Across the room, Lisa was stepping out of her clothes. She folded each item of clothing and placed it on the back of the chair. She was wearing a pink bra and pink briefs that skimmed her pubic bone. No lace, just stretchy fabric that molded smoothly to her smooth body. She reached behind her back to release the bra.
"I'll have to call you back," Rick said.
Blondes becoming extinct. Endangered species to die out in 200 years. Last blonde in 2202 in Finland. According to the BBC, a study by experts in Germany suggests people with blonde hair are an endangered species and will become extinct by 2202. Researchers predicted that the last truly natural blonde would be born in Finland, a country that boasts the highest proportion of blondes. But the scientists say too few people now carry the gene for blondes to last much longer. The researchers hinted that so-called bottle blondes may be to blame for the demise of their natural rivals. Not every scientist agrees with the prediction of impending extinction, but a study by the World Health Organization does indicate that natural blondes are likely to become extinct within the next two centuries. More recently, the probability of extinction was reviewed by the Times of London in light of new data about the evolution of the MC1R gene for blondness.
The jungle was completely silent. Not a buzzing cicada, not a hornbill cry, not a distant chattering monkey. Utterly silent. And no wonder, Hager thought. He shook his head as he looked at the 10 camera crews from around the world now clustered in little groups on the jungle floor, protecting their lenses from the dripping moisture as they peered upward into the trees overhead. He had told them to be silent, and indeed nobody was actually talking. The French crew smoked cigarettes. Although the German crew maintained silence, the cameraman kept snapping his fingers imperiously as he gestured to his assistant to do this and that. The Japanese crew from NHK was quiet, but beside them the CNN crew out of Singapore whispered and murmured and changed lenses, clanking metal boxes. The British Sky TV crew from Hong Kong had come inappropriately dressed. They now had their running shoes off and were plucking leeches from between their toes, swearing as they did so. Hopeless. Hager had warned the companies about conditions in Sumatra and the difficulty of filming there. He had recommended that they send wildlife photography teams experienced in field work. No one had listened. Instead, they had rushed the nearest available crews to Berastagi, and as a result, half the teams had talent standing by, microphones held ready, as if they were waiting to ambush a head of state. They had been waiting for 3 hours. So far, the talking orangutan had failed to make an appearance, and Hager was prepared to bet he never would. Hager caught the eye of one of the French team and gestured for him to put out his cigarette. The guy shrugged and turned his back to Hager. He continued smoking. One of the Japanese team slipped through the group and stood beside Hager. He whispered,
"When does the animal come?"
"When it's silent."
"So, you mean not today?"
Hager made a helpless gesture, palms upward.
"We are too many?"
Hager nodded.
"Perhaps tomorrow we will come alone?"
"All right," Hager said. Just then a ripple of excitement ran through the crews. They jumped to their cameras, adjusted their tripods, and began to film. Hager heard the soft murmur of voices in many languages. Nearby, the Sky TV man held his microphone close to his lips and spoke in a stage whisper.
"We are standing here deep in the remote jungles of Sumatra. And there, just across the way, we see the creature that has aroused the speculation of the entire world, the chimpanzee that is said to talk and yes, even to swear.
Christ, Hager thought. He turned to see what they were filming. He caught a glimpse of brownish fur and a dark head. The animal was clearly no larger than 2 feet tall, and almost immediately gave the low, moaning call of the pigtailed macaque. The camera crews were electrified, microphones pointed like so many gun barrels toward the quick-moving animal. They heard more moans from the distant foliage. Obviously, a good-sized troop was here. The Germans recognized it first.
999!
The cameraman stepped irritably away from the camera.
Es ist ein Macaque!
Soon the canopy overhead was thrashing as a dozen macaques swung through the area and headed north. One of the Brits turned to Hager.
Where's the chimp, then?
Orangutan, Hager said.
Whatever. Where is he?
His voice was impatient. He doesn't keep an appointment calendar, Hager said.
Is this where he's usually found? Yes. Can we put some food out for him, something to attract him? Make some mating call?
No. Hager said.
No way to attract him, is that it?
That's it.
We just sit here and hope for the best.
The journalist glanced at his watch.
They want tape by noon.
Unfortunately, Hager said, we're in the jungle. It happens when it happens. It's the natural world.
Not if it talks, it's not natural, the cameraman said. And I haven't got all fucking day.
I don't know what to tell you, Hager said.
Find me the fucking monkey,
the guy yelled. His shout agitated the macaques in the trees, made them scamper and moan. Hager looked at the others. The French cameraman said,
perhaps quieter for everybody?
Bugger off, you miserable fuckwit, the Brit said.
Easy, mate.
A huge man from the Australian crew stepped forward and put his hand on the Brit, who swung a roundhouse to his jaw. The Australian caught his hand, twisted it, and shoved him into his tripod. The tripod went down, the cameraman sprawling. The rest of the British crew jumped the Aussie, whose teammates rushed to his defense. So did the Germans. Soon 3 crews were swinging wildly. When the French tripod fell, and their camera was splattered with mud, other crews began to fight as well. Hager just stared. No orang today, he thought. Rick Deal of Biogen was changing in the locker room of the Bel Air Country Club. He had gone there to play a foursome with some investors who might be interested in Biogen, one guy from Merrill Lynch, his boyfriend, and a guy from Citibank. Rick tried to play it casual, but he felt some urgency because ever since he watched his wife walk through the lobby with that asshole in white tennis togs, he had been in a panic. Without Karen's financial backing, Rick was exposed to the untender mercies of his other major investor, Jack Watson. And that wasn't comfortable. He needed fresh money. Out there on the golf course, with the sun shining and a soft breeze blowing, he fed them his little speeches about the emerging wonders of biotech and the power of the cytokines manufactured by the Burnett cell line Biogen had acquired. It was a real opportunity to get in on a company that was about to grow fast. They didn't see it that way. The Merrill Lynch guy said, aren't lymphokines the same as cytokines? Hasn't there been some unexplained deaths from cytokines? Rick explained that there had been a few deaths some years back because a handful of physicians had jumped the gun on therapy. The Merrill Lynch guy said, I was in lymphokines 5 years ago, never made a dime. Then the Citibank guy said,
what about cytokine storms?
Cytokine storms, Christ, Rick thought. He blew his putt. Well, he said, cytokine storms are really just a speculative concept. The idea is that in certain rare circumstances, the immune system overreacts and attacks the body, causing multiple organ systems to fail.
Isn't that what happened in the influenza epidemic of 1918?
A few academics have said so, but they all work for drug companies that market competing products.
You're saying it might not be true?
You have to be very careful about what universities tell you nowadays.
Even about 1918?
Disinformation takes many forms, Rick said, picking up his ball. The truth is cytokines are the wave of the future. They are fast-tracked for clinical testing and product development, and they offer the fastest return on investment of all the product lines out there today. That's why I made cytokines my first acquisition at Biogen, and we have just won the litigation that surrounded...
They won't appeal. I heard they were.
The judge's ruling took the fight out of them.
But haven't people died from gene transfers that provoked a cytokine storm? Haven't a lot of people died?
Rick sighed. Not so many.
What, 50? 100? Something like that?
I don't know the exact number, Rick said, now realizing that this was not going to be a good day. And that was an hour before one of them finally said that in his opinion, only an idiot would invest in cytokines.
Nice.
And so he felt exhausted and defeated, sitting slumped in the locker room afterward, when Jack Watson, suntanned and resplendent in tennis whites, dropped onto the bench beside him and said, "So, useful game?"
He was the last person Deal wanted to see. "Not bad.
Any of those guys going to come in?"
"Maybe. We'll wait and see."
Watson said, "Those Merrill Lynch guys have no balls. Their idea of taking a risk is peeing in the shower. I wouldn't hold my breath. What do you think about the radial genomics business?"
"What radial genomics business?"
"I guess word hasn't gotten around. I figured you'd know about it." He bent over, began to unlace his shoes. "I just thought you'd be concerned," he said. "Didn't you have a robbery recently?"
"Yes, my car was stolen from the parking lot," Deal said.
"But I'm going through a divorce, and it's pretty bitter just now." "So you assume your wife took your car?"
"Well, yes."
"Do you know that for a fact?"
"No," Deal said, frowning. "I just assumed."
"Because that's how it started at Radial Genomics. Minor thefts of physical property. A lab assistant's car from the lot. A purse from the company dining room. An ID card from the bathroom. Nobody thought much about it. Although in retrospect, it was someone probing the system for weaknesses. They understood that after the massive databank theft."
"Databank theft?" Deal said, frowning.
"That was potentially very serious. He knew Charlie Huggins down at Genomics. He'd call him and get the full story."
"Of course," Watson said, "Huggins not admitting anything happened. They've got an IPO in June, and he knows it'd kill the offering. But the story is, last month they had 4 cell lines taken from their labs and 50 terabytes of network data removed, including backups of that data from off-site storage. Very professional job. Really set them back."
"No kidding. I'm sorry to hear that."
"Of course, I put Charlie in contact with BDG, Biological Data Group. It's a security outfit. I'm sure you know them."
BDG.
Deal couldn't remember that name, but it seemed he ought to know it.
"Of course I know BDG."
"Right. They've done security for Genentech, Wyeth, Biosyn, a dozen other places. Not that any of those guys will ever talk about what happened, but BDG is unquestionably the best when you have problems. They come in, analyze your security setup, ID your vulnerabilities, and close the network holes. Quiet, fast, confidential." Deal was thinking the only security problem he had was Jack Watson's nephew, but what he said was,
"Maybe I should talk to them."
Which was how Rick Deal found himself sitting in a restaurant across from an elegant blonde in a dark business suit. She had introduced herself as Jacqueline Maurer. She had short hair and a brisk manner. She shook hands firmly and handed him her business card. She couldn't have been more than 30. She had the tight body of a gymnast. She looked him in the eye when she spoke and was very direct. Rick glanced at the card. It had BDG in blue, and beneath, in small lettering, was her name and a phone number.
nothing else. He said, BDG has its offices where?
Many cities around the world.
And you?
I am based in San Francisco at the moment. Before that, Zurich. He was listening to her accent. He had thought it was French, but it was probably German.
You are from Zurich?
No, I was born in Tokyo. My father was in the diplomatic corps. I traveled a lot when I was young. I attended school in Paris and Cambridge. I worked first for Crédit Lyonnais in Hong Kong because I speak Mandarin and Cantonese. Then I went to Lombard Odier in Geneva, private bank.
The waiter came. She ordered mineral water, a brand he did not know.
What is that? He said. It's Norwegian. Very good.
He ordered the same. And how did you get to BDG? He asked.
2 years ago, in Zurich.
Rick said, What were the circumstances?
I'm sorry, I can't say. A company had a problem. BDG was brought in to solve it. I was asked to help. Some technical issues. I subsequently joined them.
A company in Zurich had a problem? She smiled.
I'm sorry.
What companies have you worked with since joining BDG?
I'm not free to say.
Rick frowned. He was thinking this was going to be a very weird interview if she couldn't tell him anything.
You realize, she said, that data theft is a global concern. It affects companies around the world. Estimated losses of 1 trillion euros annually. No company wishes its problems made public, so we respect the privacy of our clients.
Rick said, What exactly can you tell me?
Think of any large banking or scientific or pharmaceutical firm. We have probably done work for them.
Very discreet.
As we will be discreet with you. We will send only 3 persons to your company, including me. We will identify ourselves as due diligence accountants for a VC firm that is thinking of investing. We will spend 1 week reviewing your status and then report to you.
Very straightforward. Very direct. He tried to focus on what she was saying, but he found her beauty distracting.
She did not make the slightest sexual gesture, not a glance, not a body movement, not a touch. Yet she was immensely sexy.
No bra, he could see that. Firm breasts beneath a silk blouse.
Mr. Deal, she said.
She was staring at him. He must have drifted off. I'm sorry, he shook his head. It's been a very difficult time.
We are aware of your personal stresses, she said, and also of your security issues. I mean, the political aspects of your security.
Yes, he said. We have a head of security, a man named Bradley.
He must be replaced immediately, she said. I know, he said, but his uncle... Leave all that to us, she said.
The waiter came back, and she ordered lunch.
As the conversation continued, he felt more and more drawn to her. Jacqueline Maurer had an exotic quality, and a personal reserve that he found challenging.
It was not difficult to decide to hire her. He wanted to see her again. At the end of the meal, they walked outside. She shook hands firmly. When will you start? He said.
Immediately. Today, if you like.
Yes, good, he said.
All right, then. We will visit your headquarters in 4 days.
Not today?
Oh, no. We start today, but we must address your political problem first. Then we will come.
A black town car pulled up. The driver came around to open the door for her.
Oh, and by the way, she said, your port